Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're broadcast all over the world. We are the number one listened to progressive radio program anywhere. And the numbers are growing. And I want to thank, we have about 19 different servers. One of them this morning showed 10 million. So we have people listening. Why? Why would they choose us when there are hundreds of thousands of other programs they could listen to? In part because we give the best information on health and healing, and we will that today. For example, from the Cleveland Clinic, published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell, Host, and Microbe, a study about the Western diet, the diet most Americans eat, is found to impair the function of the immune cells in your gut. That's important since we know that the healthy diet, healthy bacteria, healthy biome, healthy person, unhealthy foods, unhealthy bacteria, unhealthy immune system. But we are going to get to that and many other subjects on health and healing, slowing down the aging process, later in our program. Normally, we always start with this, but we have a guest on the line now, and she is in Israel. As a result, we want to be able to have her early because it's a whole lot different hour than what she is used to. And we're going to take a look at the new RNA vaccine injuries and deaths in the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Event Database. She is Dr. Jessica Rose, R-O-S-E. She is a highly respected immunologist, molecular biologist, specializing in computational biology and the biomechanisms behind pathogenic infections. Her research and peer-reviewed publications, including looking at hepatitis B, cytomegalovirus, HIV, and anthrax. And she's a graduate at the University of Newfoundland and Labrador, and she received also her doctorate from major university in Israel, and she has also published a new article out just this month in the peer-reviewed Science, Public Health, Policy, and Law, which analyzed the data of COVID-19 vaccine injuries and deaths reported in the CDC's Adverse Events Reporting System, or VAERS. Nice to have you with us today, Jessica.
Hi. Wow, that was a really nice introduction. Thank you. Thank you for having me, too.
We're happy to. And part of the reason that we invited you on is because you are one of tens of thousands of qualified scientists or board-certified physicians, mainstream, who are trying to look for the truth in what is frequently becoming confused rhetoric by officials within the World Health Organization, the CDC, the FDA, the White House, both the current White House and the former White House on their COVID advisory panels, of what is right and what is not, what is accurate and what is misinformation. And the public, not having a background, most of them in science, certainly not in public health, simply trust whatever they're told. And the mainstream media has been, with one voice, consistent in defending whatever Anthony Fauci or others in the official position have to say. Those who choose to look at the data and come to a different decision are frequently criticized. They're erased from any of the normal channels, such as they would not be allowed on any of the networks to give their points of view, even if it's from a peer-reviewed journal and has been independently verified as accurate. Whereas people coming forward who have not treated people with COVID, and we asked, and they do not have a background in the specific sciences, but they're there to give certainty that everything you're being told about the vaccines are that it's safe and effective. For the average person, effective means if I take the vaccine, I will be protected from the COVID virus. And yet, that is not what we're finding, and especially in Israel. So if you would please take your time, we would like for you to break down for us the actual total numbers found in the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System database, and what they're claiming are the vaccine injuries and deaths, and knowing that it's voluntary. And as we know, and we've reported many times over the years, it is a passive reporting system, and therefore it is only reporting a fraction of the actual numbers. Now, I interviewed personally the former head of the FDA, and he said at that time that the numbers could be anywhere from 1% to 10%. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to be very conservative and go with 10% when we have even had a Harvard University study estimating that it's 1% to 2% of all adverse effects. Nevertheless, since your article has published, a number of injuries and additional deaths have continued to increase. And as we speak today, the European system of accounting for the deaths and injuries, the injuries are above 500,000, approaching 500,000, and the deaths are at a remarkable almost 11,000.
What?
Now, yes.
Wow.
Yes, 11,000. It was 10,480 just a week ago, but it's increasing. In essence, we're losing about 30 Americans per day. Every 24 hours, someone is dying from the COVID vaccines. That's according to the government's, and that's very conservative. It could be nine times that amount. It could easily be that. So would you take your time and take us through what your research has found that you've published, and it's a matter of the facts being out there now. The form is yours.
Thank you. Okay, let's start with numbers because everyone can relate to that. Yeah, everything you said is absolutely true. It's probably frightening in reality how many adverse events are ongoing that are not being either reported due to people not knowing about the system or not being recorded. And there's another level to that too. They might have been recorded, but they're not being entered into the database because they don't qualify. I found out about that the other day. A person had entered five adverse event reports to a reporting system in Canada, and five adverse event reports were rejected. They didn't qualify. So there are many, many levels here. And when you take it all into account, the actual numbers are probably two orders of magnitude higher than what I'm going to read to you right now. So the VAERS database is updated every Friday afternoon my time. So it's become an exciting day for me for morbid reasons, but that's how it is. The total number of adverse event reports as of last Friday is 182,559. The total number of dead are 4,015, so we're a little behind the UK. Hospitalizations are at 12,000. Emergency room visit reports are 24,000. And I have taken the time to subdivide the adverse events into categories because there are thousands of different types. There are 2,834 different types of adverse events that range from, say, injection site pain to death. It's a very broad range of reports. So I'm going to tell you the numbers for three of the most prominent categories, which are cardiovascular events, neurological events, and immunological events. The cardiovascular events as of last Friday are at 31,400. I'm rounding the numbers off. The neurological adverse event count is at 20,000, and the immunological, which is the most frightening, is at 68,836. Now, anybody who doesn't know, I'm sure your viewing audience absolutely knows something about the immune system, but any kind of immunological dysfunction that is detected in the context of a treatment, whatever it may be, biological or pharmaceutical, it's a sign. It's an alarm bell. You have to pay attention to something like that, because if you have a dysfunctional element of your immune system, whether it be your innate branch or your adaptive branch, you're going to have problems, which can range from inflammation, arthritis, to demyelination diseases. These are very serious adverse events. Spontaneous abortions, which are not counted as deaths, by the way, we're at 108. And this brings me to severe adverse events. So the VAERS database, or any database, I think, divides adverse events up into two categories. There are mild adverse events and severe adverse events. So for the most part, the adverse events are mild. And the VAERS handbook puts that percentage of mild adverse events, or excuse me, severe adverse events, at 15% on average. The VAERS system has been on the go since 1990. So this is based on data that goes back to 1990. So we have been since December 17th approximately, and since January, when the VAERS data started rolling in, we have been consistently above that number. We're now, as of last Friday, we are at 19% severe adverse events, which is 4% higher than the standard. And we peaked last February at 57%, which is, whoa, it's quite striking. That brings me to the next statistic. For anyone who doesn't know, what it's called when you actually get the, let's call it the disease that you're trying to protect yourself from when you get a vaccine, when you get that disease anyway, it's called a breakthrough infection. So this is becoming a topic of conversation in the scientific community right now and in many many media communities. Breakthrough COVID-19 infections are becoming a thing in the context of the injections. So we're currently at 3,317 breakthrough infections. And what that means is that the people who got the injections ended up with COVID anyway. And of those people, 179 of them died. So if that's not ironic, I don't know what is. What else do we have? There's one more, anaphylaxis. This is also a topic of interest in many people and has actually been cause for them pulling one of the vaccine lots from Moderna out of the market in California due to, you know, the commonality of anaphylaxis following the injection. So we are currently at 843. You were saying, I heard you about to ask something.
Yes, please. The CDC and the media in general downplay the significance of adverse effects, including death. They're not talking about it. They just keep stating the same mantra over and over. It's safe and effective. It's safe and effective. And if you dare challenge it, no matter what your background, no matter what evidence you have, for example, Facebook will completely delete you and you'll be canceled. Google, the same. You'll be pillared on Wikipedia and you'll also be taken off all the other sites, the major platforms. In effect, there's a massive censorship program going on. Then we find out that it's not by accident that governmental agencies working with the media and the tech firms have set up so-called fact checkers that are not fact checkers at all. It's anyone who's critical of anything is immediately censored. But in the realm of honest debate and dialogue, I'm a scientist, you're a scientist. I was a senior research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, head of the anti-aging division for 33 years. We had vigorous debates all the time. It was done civilly, but it was done with people having their point of view to see whose point of view ultimately would prevail. And even that might change in time. And yet we're told today you cannot debate. There is no openness. You have freedom of speech only if you comport with their sense of what freedom of speech is. Otherwise, you're censored, then you're attacked, then you're ridiculed. It's one thing to say I disagree with you with all due politeness. It's another thing to say that you're a danger to society and you should be repelled out of society as quickly as possible, and that's exactly what's happening. The difference is that there's so many people who are coming forward with outstanding credentials and saying, we have been misled on so many things. Is it a real virus? Yes. Is it deadly? Absolutely. Has it killed a lot of people? Yes, it has. Could we have done something to prevent it? The answer is yes, we could have. Then why didn't we? And then that's where a lot of doctors, frontline doctors and scientists are saying we have FDA-approved drugs that could have intervened, and yet Fauci and group are saying you could only treat someone once they have to go into a hospital. But what about between being infected and going in the hospital? Surely. And the answer was no, there is nothing else. So I'm concerned that I do not know what anyone's agenda is. I'm not going to speculate. I do know that in a society that now censors everybody, that is not a healthy society. We must have open and honest dialogue. And science in particular, when science becomes orthodox, it ceases to be real science. It becomes a cult. Your thoughts on this, please.
I completely agree with you. And that's also why it's so hard to get through to so many people, because we're not having a debate, and we're not, you can't make someone think that their beliefs are wrong because they're their beliefs. So I just said this to someone. I've actually been confronted with this problem with many close friends. And it's like, from a psychological point of view, it's almost as if you have to shatter their the whole infrastructure of how they think, because if they accept that even there might be a risk, not is, might be a risk associated with these injections, and nobody's telling them, it means that they have to accept that something's being hidden from them. And then they have to ask why. And then they might find out that they're being lied to. And then they have to start wondering if they can trust these authorities that they've placed their trust in for so long. And then they might have to completely suspend all of their prior beliefs. So I don't think a lot of people are ready to do that, which is, it's so manipulative of the bodies, the governing bodies who are setting up this infrastructure. Makes me very angry, actually.
Well, then respond on this, please. Do you have any thoughts about the U.S. health officials underreporting the actual number of COVID vaccine adverse effects? Their motivations to do so are in question, since their job is to keep propagating the myth that the vaccines are all safe and all effective, and if someone died, it had nothing to do with the vaccine. And this harkens back to when a Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, he was one of the top Illinois physicians, and he, in fact, he was head of the State Medical Association for a period of time, and he began to look carefully, he was a pediatrician, at some of the adverse reactions of children who were receiving the DPT shot in particular at that time, and he found that this was not helping them, it was actually harming them. And we as a society were not recognizing that this generation in the 1960s and 70s and 80s were getting vaccines where we weren't paying attention to what was happening to the child, such as inner ear infections and other conditions. So he began a campaign. I met him, and we did some work together on doing research. Well, I've interviewed over 1,000 parents in the last 20 years whose children were normal till they were vaccinated. Now, this is not a statement against vaccines. This is a statement showing that we should first always engage in the precautionary principle. First,
absolutely.
Let's make sure that these are absolutely safe for all the children, and I have found that that has not been done. They are using, for example, methotrexate they're using a different vaccine as instead of a saline solution in one of the trials, and yet we were told publicly it was all saline. It wasn't. They bypassed all the animal experiments. And now you have the final insult. We have all these children who've been damaged, and the parents say it's the vaccine because my child was normal, and we have the entirety of the FDA and CDC and the scientific community saying, no, it wasn't. You're misguided, you're not scientific, you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm thinking, well, if the mother doesn't know her own child, then the doctor's supposed to be the expert and not the mother of what is normal. And also the last thing is, and this is your specialty, so please take your time on this because we need your answer. It is my understanding that when we have a immune reaction to an antigen, let's say a virus, and the body creates a defense and is able to defeat the virus, now we have a form of natural, a form of applied immunity. We're able then to meet that virus in the future and have a good chance of not having us get sick because of it. And yet they're taking all the people who've been infected with the COVID virus, some with symptoms, some with no symptoms, some with major symptoms, but now they're okay, and they're saying you all must get vaccinated. And I'm having to ask, please show me the scientific peer-reviewed literature that Richard Gale and I have looked for weeks, that thousands of studies show us where this is justified when someone has natural immunity, that you're now going to say we're going to give you a vaccine-caused immunity. And I'm seeing where there are studies showing you could also be interfering in that person's natural immune response and could, in susceptible people, cause a vaccination in an already COVID survivor to cause an autoimmune reaction that could be adverse to their health. Could you please tell us your expertise on this?
Yes, that can happen. And can I swear?
Sure, you can.
That's absolute bullshit. Nobody who has natural immunity needs to ever get vaccinated. That's what the immune system is for, to protect the human entity from pathogens, including viruses. And the purpose of vaccinating or inoculating someone is to give them a dose, a small dose, or a minor disease course to activate their immune system to generate a response in the form of antibodies, for example, to provide what is normally lifelong protection. Or that's in the case of natural immunity. In the case of vaccines, sometimes you need a booster. It's not necessarily lifelong. Many people would say it's never lifelong, and they might be right as well. It's absolute nonsense that anybody who has natural immunity, and you can prove that with a serology test to detect specific antibodies, absolute nonsense that they have to go anywhere near an injection that's meant to protect them from COVID. I don't even know where to start with that. But to go back to the previous question, I didn't know this until recently because I'm like you. I don't even want to speculate as to what's going on here. I want to find out what I can do to help people learn more about the real data. I want them to have the information so that they can make the choices for themselves about their own health. That's what everyone should be doing. So I learned that it's not possible for any product, any biological product, to have emergency use authorization granted if there are drugs on the market that are FDA approved that work in the context of the pathogen. So as you know, and as most of your listeners probably know, there are a number of pharmaceutical drugs and treatments that that have been shown to be effective in peer-reviewed studies all over the world. Many labs, many papers. I mean, there's 250,000 peer-reviewed papers on COVID so far. Not all of them are on that subject, but there are treatments that are effective. And there's actually a new product coming out of Canada. It's a nitric oxide nasal spray, which is a hell of a lot better than a jab, which has been shown to be not 99% effective. It's been shown to be 100% effective at eradicating virus. So nobody ends up in the ICU. I mean, this is prevention at its best. So there are a number, my point is there are a number of products and treatments and drugs that have been FDA approved for decades that are absolutely safe. We've had them in the human population for decades, that are effective at treating COVID at various stages of the disease. And this includes people who are in the hospital. People have turned around. So if those drugs were promoted to be effective and everybody started using them, then these injections would not have been able to get past whatever review boards they had to get past to become emergency authorization usable. So I thought that was a little bit sketchy. I think I'd like to talk. I don't know how much time we have, but before I forget, you did kind of hint on causation. I might be wrong about that, but it's a very important topic.
Please address it.
Yes. I published a manuscript recently on this, and I also have presented a summary presentation with three of the main important points that I found in my data analysis. One of them was pointing to causation. Now, in the VAERS front page, when you go to their site, says, now be careful with this data and don't draw conclusions, you know, the blah, blah, blah. And they kind of warn you about not being able to associate this, like not being able to say that this causes this. However, what I did was I have my data in groupings. Like I pulled all the deaths, I pulled all the hospitalizations, I pulled all the ER visits, I pulled all the cardiovascular adverse events, the neurological and the immunological adverse events from the database using my fancy R. And what I did was I calculated the difference in time, in days, between the vaccination date and the onset of symptoms. So whenever they called and said, okay, my symptoms started this day. And in every single category, there wasn't one where I didn't find this. The highest percentage of time frames, like the duration of time post-vaccination, were between day zero, which means like any time between like 15 seconds to 23 hours and 59 minutes. It was between day zero and one. So if there was no, so I'm probably not explaining this right. Maybe I should go back to the beginning. I don't want anyone to get confused by what I'm saying. I actually do have a really good way to explain this. But if there was no causation, there would be absolutely no clustering around day zero or the number of days following an infection being zero and one. We would expect the percent of reported adverse events to be the same for any given time period before or after the injection, if there was no causation. Maybe that's a better way to say it. I'm not sure anyone can visualize this, but imagine you have an XY plot, two-dimensional plot, and on the X-axis, that's the bottom one, you have the number of days following injection. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, blah, blah, blah. And then on the Y-axis, you have a percentage of reported adverse events. So if you assume that the injections have absolutely nothing to do with the onset of adverse events, let's say death, like they didn't cause the person to die, then what we'd expect to see, like I said, is that it would be the percentage of the reported adverse event death would be the same. So along the x-axis and about the y-axis. So we would just see a straight line. They could have even died before the injection if there's no causation. So my point is, that's absolutely not what I saw in each one of these categories. There's a clustering of reports around day zero and one, which means that most of the reports in many categories were made right away. So I'm saying that I have very strong evidence based on the Bradford Hill criteria. This is how you prove causality in epidemiology, that these injections are causing these adverse events. And if anybody's out there who has like statistical evidence or scientific evidence to provide an explanation why that's happening, in the context of no causation, I would love to hear it. I'm not being argumentative. I really would. Like, I'm all about discussion and back and forth, and I could be totally wrong.
Well, what you're saying is you're honoring Koch's postulates right now.
Yeah.
And that's what's important. Do you remember I don't know if you saw it in Israel, one of the spokespersons who was a nurse, took the vaccine, was smiling, got up to the microphone, and collapsed about 60 seconds later and died. That should have immediately sent up a red flag. We had a physician who said, oh, the vaccine, those who don't get the vaccine are just, you know, conspiracy theorists, et cetera. He took the vaccine and died. We've had so many people who thought that there was no problem at all until they got it. My concern is this. Go back to the swine flu vaccine. Go back to previous times when we were told that we had to vaccinate 40 million Americans. That's what they did. Based upon the swine flu, which was pandemic level, and it turns out it wasn't, but some people died, and it was a big crisis. It was a big controversy. Now, let's go to the current pharmaceutical industry standards. If you have a number of deaths, let's say up to about 15 deaths, you may be able to keep your product on the market, but it's going to be the FDA is going to give you a black box warning. So the person taking it, you're going to see that. If you go above 30 deaths, you're going to have that product withdrawn from the market.
Yep.
No questions about it. And that's been historical. If you have, let's say, two to 300 adverse effects, you're going to get a black box warning. If you have 1,000 adverse effects, you're going to have it withdrawn from the market. That's the history. We studied this. We spent 3 weeks looking at all the data on this. Now we're talking about over 100,000 adverse effects and tens of thousands, serious. Many of those may succumb. And we're talking about over 4,100 deaths. We've never had a product in American history that had 4,000 people just in the United States die, 10,000 in the European Union's 27 countries. That does not include Great Britain. And suddenly nobody thinks that's a big deal. You put those two together, not even Great Britain. If you just put the United States and the European Union's statistics together, you're at 15,000 dead. Tell me the last time any medical procedure or medical device or drug was allowed that killed minimally 15,000. And if you take the most conservative 90%, then you got to multiply that times 9. And now you're not at 15,000 dead from just two different segments of the population. It's relatively simple. You take 15,000 and you multiply that times 9, and you're at 135,000 dead. Or put it a different way, that's more people who died than twice as many as died in the Vietnam War. And that doesn't get anyone's attention. There's not a single critical article in the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, Miami Herald, the LA Times about, gee whiz, maybe we should stop until we test this thing properly instead of allowing people around the world to be the human guinea pigs. And why is that? Well, who is the number one person in the world, more important, more powerful, and wealthier than anyone else promoting this whole pandemic? Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. Now, Bill Gates is now treated much like a living god. He gives money everywhere. But I did some research on Bill Gates, and here's what I found. Please listen. This is only a two-minute clip from 60 Minutes. Leslie Stahl interviewing Bill Gates' partner, the man, Paul Allen. Huh?
I know
listen
this,
to what he,
yeah.
Listen to what he has to say about Bill Gates' character.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about his yelling, screaming.
There was a lot of yelling.
You guys never understood. You never understood the first thing about this.
A 1994 CBS News profile got a sample of Gates' management style, which Allen describes as browbeating and personal verbal attacks.
That's ridiculous. I'm not doing this thing.
No. Somebody's confused. Somebody's just not thinking.
I mean, there's no way.
We'll figure it out.
You had to fight back intensely to stand your ground and make your position and your convictions expressed.
But he didn't like to back down. So these fights would go on, you said. They could go on for hours.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
We're just screaming at each other for hours?
And it's exhausting. It's exhausting, but that was Bill's style.
Allen was miserable and felt he was being marginalized. And then things got a lot worse. He got cancer. One night he passed by Gates's office and overheard him talking with Steve Ballmer, who'd been hired to help run the company.
What were they saying?
They were basically talking about how they were planning to dilute my share down to almost nothing. And it was really a shocking and disheartening moment for me.
And you were sick?
Well, I think I was still probably in the middle of radiation therapy.
He burst in and interrupted them. He says they were trying to cut him out and rip him off.
And, of course, Steve came over to my house later that night to apologize.
He did?
He did.
But Bill didn't come.
No, he sent Steve.
He sent Steve. It wasn't Steve. He sent Steve.
Well, Steve's the one who came.
Now, add that together. A person who must dominate everything. Now we find out that he also was a serial offender in infidelity against his wife and the sanctity of their marriage. And now this has come out. And now we found out that not only was he friends with Jeffrey Epstein, but as of this morning, the latest report is that he wanted Epstein to open a door so he could get nominated for a Nobel Prize. He also was a part of what was called the Men's Club, where they would talk about the things in their life in a private way. And knowing full well that Epstein was a convicted child pedophile. And so what does it tell you about a person? But that's only part of it. Also, there are articles that we have. In fact, a brand new article that shows that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was supplying money, huge amounts of money, to GMOs, and the GMOs or non-governmental organization NGOs, and he's a nonprofit foundation, but they were buying ownership in these vaccine companies and pharmaceutical companies, so they were both giving money tax deductible, and then making money. And in fact, he's already admitted he's made somewhere around, I think it's $20 billion on a relatively small investment. And then we find out that he was testing vaccines, including the Gardasil vaccine, the Cervarix vaccine in India, in the poorest area of India, with illiterate people and not getting parental support for the child, not explaining, and seven of those children died. No one in the media has said, your actions caused the death of seven children and the injury of thousands of others. So now people are beginning to pull down the sainthood mask and see the real person. So the question is this a person that you want to trust when he says everybody has to get vaccinated and then booster vaccines on top of that? And then you should get a digital implant so we can track your vaccine schedule. And then let's have a vaccine passport. He's the brains behind all this. And not a single article challenging him, not a single statement from any governmental agency that he's given money to, and he has utter control over the World Health Organization, to begin to see that maybe we have all been given misdirection on this serious virus and made it something that if reasonable and responsible scientists and public health officials had intervened, it would have had a completely different outcome, saving hundreds of thousands of lives and saving tens of millions of people from the horror of being quarantined. Your thoughts, please, Jessica.
Well, let's go back a year and something ago. And I haven't thought twice about that guy since. He's not a scientist. So why would anyone care what he says about anything having to do with science? And that's it. All anybody has to do is are the very, very basics. And that's what you should do. Like, I'm sure most people are, you know, they're pretty trusting when it comes to the going to the doctor and listening to their doctor and filling prescriptions and all that stuff. But I think that people should be far more responsible, personally responsible for themselves and for their kids, because, you know, kids are kids. And just look things up a little bit. Look at package inserts. Find out what something, some drug or some biological is meant to do, and do a little bit of reading about whether or not it's going to benefit you personally. So all you have to do is go to one of the websites of the manufacturers of these, let's say, the mRNA products. And I truly believe that is all anyone has to do to become a little bit hesitant, just to start asking themselves without being coerced from external mediums, if that product is in their best interest. Now, on that subject, and on the subject of mRNA products, for the viewers who don't know, I'd really like to clear this up. First of all, these products are not vaccines. Vaccines are attenuated viruses, etc., viral bits that are used as inoculations to stimulate the immune system to render you protected in the future. It takes 10 to 15 years for these things to get approved and on the market by the FDA. It's highly, highly regulated because biologicals do not have to go through the ropes that pharmaceuticals do. There are no pharmacokinetic studies. There's none of that. So they have to go through this rigorous and long testing protocol before they get into humans. That did not happen here, first of all. We jetted through this in, 6 months? Something like that. And there had been some anecdotal studies in cancer patients that did not go very well. This is the very first time that mRNA templates and lipid nanoparticles, which are the carriers for these templates, have been used in the context of global setting against in an attempt to fight a virus, an attempt to reduce transmission of a virus, for example. It's never been done before. This is brand new, okay? That, again, is something that everyone should be learning about. I'm not telling you what to do, but you have to inform yourself because you might think again if you start looking around at what's being published. The mRNA, this stands for message RNA, for those who don't know, messenger RNA, for those who don't know. And everybody has messenger RNAs ubiquitously in their bodies. So we're all made of DNA. And DNA effectively gets transcribed into what we call messenger RNA. And then that effectively gets translated into proteins. And proteins are the building blocks of life. So all of our cells have this machinery. And this is part of a normally functioning being. So what this new technology does is it utilizes that system within our host cells. So the mRNA template, which is allegedly, and I do mean that, encoding the spike protein of the coronavirus. And the reason I say allegedly is because I've actually asked the companies for the sequences of these mRNA templates because we're absolutely not privy to know what these sequences are, which basically means that we have no idea what these mRNAs are going to encode in the end. And that's not even touching on contamination or the fact that a lot of the templates are going to be a little bit shorter and they're going to end up encoding smaller proteins and that might even lead to a prion disease, but we're not going to talk about that. So these mRNAs are very fragile. And so how they deliver them into the human cells is via being wrapped in a lipid nanoparticle. And it's also, there are some other lipids involved there. One of them is a cationic lipid, which is very, very, very toxic to cells. So this package is not something highly desirable on its own. So they inject a solution of these lipid nanoparticles carrying the mRNAs. They go into your muscle cells. They get uptaken by antigen-presenting cells, they get shuttled to the lymph nodes, etc. And eventually, certain cells start, the mRNA gets released from its package. It finds this thing called a ribosome, and the mRNA is translated into this protein, the spike protein. and so on and so on. So we become the manufacturing machines for an exogenous protein, a protein that is from the outside of the body, a brand new thing, which is why the design it's a brilliant idea in theory, but it's meant to stimulate our immune systems to mount an effective and powerful response against this foreign protein that your body is making. So what ends up happening is that you have these specific proteins called antibodies being produced against those spike proteins. So you have this very specific army of antibodies clearing these spike proteins from your body. And hypothetically, what's meant to happen is that if you meet these antigenic particles in the future, that you have these specific antibodies to mount a response. But that's if you meet something very specific. So some people claim that this is actually going to become a huge problem for some people who meet the coronavirus in reality in the future. The theory is that because there are these very specific antibodies that are going to rush to the front line to try and remove this virus, but because they're very, very specific to certain antigenic protein, they're not going to be able to clear the virus with a great amount of efficiency. So the virus might actually end up causing more problems than good. So I won't talk much more about that. That was a long spiel I just did. It's too bad we don't have questions on the go. It would be really nice because I could hear what people are thinking in response to what I said.
But the audience is listening and taking note, and this audience is known for doing their independent homework.
Good.
That said, what about the 130,500,000 Americans alone who already have a classified autoimmune condition?
Yeah.
Did they do any studies that you're aware of that would have shown by using only people with autoimmune conditions and elderly people with autoimmune conditions and people with comorbidities what this might do?
No, because they were in the exclusion criteria list. So kids aren't allowed in, pregnant women aren't allowed in, you're not allowed in if you're breastfeeding, you're not allowed in if you have an autoimmune condition, if you have cancer, blah, blah. The list is very, very long. So that's another thing I was screaming about at the top of my lungs and I thought really naively that everyone would listen, but I'm like, listen.
But then those same people are being mandated to have the vaccine. Isn't that hypocritical?
I live in a place where, the coercion is so strong. I mean, it's, what is it, like 65% of the population's already had two injections, and now they're going after the kids. And there's no resistance because people are like, well, you know, I don't want to lose my job. You know, that's how it is here. So,
but also in Israel, is it not the case that they now have a two-tiered system for all intents and purposes? Those who have been vaccinated can go in places that those who have not are excluded from?
Yes.
Well, that is not a healthy situation.
I haven't been in a restaurant in 16 months, and it's kind of sad for me because one of my favorite things to do is to go out to eat. Like, I used to go out to eat like twice a week. And I tip like a Rockefeller. I mean, it's really sad. It's I don't even go into stores anymore. We get our food ordered from a farm, get dropped off at our door. I mean, I wasn't a big shopper before, but I'm not a shopper anymore. I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry about them not being in school. But one of my best friends just sent me a message today. I mean, she's like, Jess, I don't know what people are doing. I mean, if I was working full time, she has three little girls. And she said, if I was working full time, my little girls haven't been in school. I don't know what I'd be doing. But this is the reality for a lot of women. They are trying to work full time, but they, as single moms, let's say, or even not. And they have kids and there's nowhere for their kids to go. And if aren't vaccinated soon, they're not even going to be able to go to like a daycare. I mean, it's really sickening.
Oh, hold on one second, Jessica. I may have something that could help you with that. And to all the people in this audience, I had a caller yesterday ask a very specific question about where her child should go since college is requiring it. I want to share something for everyone, no matter where you're at in the world, because this is a worldwide issue. This is a matter of federal law. Quote, federal law prohibits mandates of emergency use COVID vaccines, tests, and masks. Three resources you can use to inform your school or your employer. Under federal law, employers and universities cannot, I repeat, cannot legally mandate COVID vaccines because they are unlicensed emergency use authorization products, which are by definition experimental. And it goes on that that with more than 100 university colleges and colleges mandating COVID vaccines for in-person attendance in schools enforcing mask mandate, it's critical people understand their rights. The bottom line is this. Mandating products authorized for emergency use authorization status violates federal law as detailed in legal notifications. And then the defender, the Children's Health Defense, has the exact law that you can use because you're on the right side if you say, I do not have to be vaccinated to come into this school. You have the federal law on your side, but the public's not aware of it, and the media has been absolutely abysmal in telling people what their actual rights are. So we're posting that on PRN today.
That's great. Yeah, whatever's happening in the world, it's like 10,000 times worse here. We're a country with kind of like a military infrastructure. So like if something is mandated, like masks have been mandated for like over a year, they enforce it. They still have people walking around. I got stopped today. It's so crazy to me. I have never worn a mask. I never will. I've stood in front of many security guy, policemen, and I talked English, and I explained to them who I am and why I'm not wearing a mask. And it's not because I'm exempt. It's because they don't do anything to protect you from viruses. An N95 mask can protect you from air pollution, which is a way more concerning talking piece. But it's not about sense. It's not about health. It's not about logic. It never has been. And it's not been clearer anywhere than here. It's so hypocritical, the whole thing. And some people still don't see it, but I've been seeing it from, like, I think it was February. I was one of the people who was looking at this last January, and I was like, oh my God, because I was meant to fly to Australia. And my flight was through China. And just when this broke out was when I was meant to be going through Shenzhen Airport. And my flight got canceled because of this thing. And I'm like, uh-oh. And the epidemiologist in me started waking up. And I was like, uh-oh. So then I started sounding the alarm bells because I was meant to compete in the Noosa Festival of Surfing that year. And I was like, listen, I don't think I'm going to be able to go. And maybe kind of like keep this on the down low, but there's this virus in China that maybe people should be aware of. And so I was one of the people like really being responsible about conveying information, but it became just too obvious in a very short amount of time with the change. We literally have changes in mandates, not measures, mandates every day here. And it was ludicrous.
Well, look at the mandate. Jessica, we're coming out of time. I just want to say a few things. The CDC now has says, yeah, you could go outside without the mask, you've been vaccinated. And yet I can show them the science, actual science, OSHA science, peer review science, showing that a virus, any of these viruses, is going to go right through that mask. It's a thousand times smaller than the pores could stop it. So that's not the reason to wear a mask. There are other reasons if you want to wear a mask. But they've been misguiding. And also right now, I'm very concerned that pregnant women should be very concerned because the potential interference, this RNA spike protein, upon a growing fetus. There are some physicians and obstetricians, gynecologists, who are noticing problems in the females working who are pregnant in their own clinics. And so it hasn't gotten up to everyone's attention yet, but it will. And also now they want to vaccinate all the kids and I'm saying, show me the peer-reviewed literature that children are at any statistical significant rate of dying from COVID, and it doesn't exist.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, because as part of my investigation into the children, like, okay, so I'm going to be very specific here. I calculated the ratio of children who have died, I'm sorry for the morbid topic, as a byproduct of SARS-CoV-2, you know, they got COVID and died. And by child, the CDC defines this between 0 and 18 years of age, okay? So I calculated that ratio, and I calculated the ratio of the number of children who have died as a ratio of the total number who have died as per the reports in the VAERS data set, okay? So the two numbers, two ratios, the SARS NCoV-2 deaths is at 0.06%, okay? This is a very low number. And I want to stress that this number is very stable. This data has been being collected for over a year. It's not changing. More children aren't dying. This is a very stable number, okay? So that alone, it should be enough for anyone with a child to say, listen, this is not a problem. Like, you know, I'm not going to throw gasoline on a fire, you know. That should be alone enough. But the ratio of children who died as per the total number who died as per the VAERS data set is 0.5, which is 8.5 times higher. And I also want to point out two things here. One, this is only from data that started being collected in late December, early January. So this is very early, and it's already many times higher. And number two, this is not including spontaneous abortions. So I don't want to get into a debate about, you know, whether a fetus is a person or not, but I count that as a death. So if you count that in the death total versus the total deaths, that 0.5 goes up to 5.43, which is about 10,000 times more likely of dying from the injection than you are from the virus if you're from 0 to 18. So
Jessica, Jessica, we're going to invite you back because we've gone through an hour. We're out of time.
My God. Wow, that was fast.
I just want to say thank you for having the courage to put your reputation out there and let people know you're going to tell the truth. We respect that. And you will always have a forum that you can share your ideas here on our network.
Thank you very much.
From Israel, Dr. Jessica Rose, immunologist, molecular biologist, and a scientist of great respect, who's just published in a major peer-reviewed journal, Science, Public Health, Policy, and the Law. And she's taking issue with a lot of issues that we are now told believe the authorities. And I'm saying I'd rather believe the experts than the authorities, because the authorities are not experts. They're using us as humane guinea pigs. And that does not mean anti-vaccine. To the contrary, pro-vaccine. But let us use the precautionary principle. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.